Many observers expected the superintendent of public instruction race in the general election to include the incumbent. I'm Steve Goldstein. On today's Here and Now, I'll talk with Democratic superintendent nominee David Garcia. He's taking on Republican Diane Douglas, who defeated current superintendent John Hupenthal in the August primary. I'll find out how Garcia intends to improve K-12 education in Arizona if he's elected. The superintendent race isn't the only one that's included some unexpected moments. The campaigns for attorney general, governor, corporation commission, and Congress have included intense accusations. On this eve of early ballots being mailed out, I'll ask Bob Robb and Chad Campbell what stood out for them. Plus, Arizona State's athletic program has a lot of competition in the Valley. I'll talk with ASU's athletic director Ray Anderson about how the department can excel, and I'll find out from Anderson, a former NFL executive, how the league should work to improve its image. Here and Now is next on KJZZ. The news is first. It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, I'll talk with ASU Athletic Director Ray Anderson about how competitive the program can be in this pro sports dominated market. Anderson was also recently an executive with the NFL, so we'll discuss the league's image problems. Also, KJZZ's Nick Blumberg will join us to have the latest on same-sex marriage. And early ballots for November's general election go out tomorrow. We've been inundated with negative ads and accusations against candidates, so what stands out? I'll ask Bob Robb and Chad Campbell. One interesting race is the battle to become Arizona's next superintendent of public schools. Republican Diane Douglas beat incumbent John Hupenthal in the August primary. We invited her to join us today but did not receive confirmation. The Democratic nominee for superintendent is David Garcia, who did accept our invitation and joins us now. David, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me.
What is going right with Arizona's K-12 education? What needs to change ASAP?
Well, I think there's a number of things going right in K-12 education. We have what I think can be the most innovative public school system in the country because we're small, we're flexible, we're fearless, and we have had so many changes in Arizona. Parents have options here that other parents in other states don't have. We've got so many resources available to us. I think our educators have been doing a fine job. But one of the key things we need to change is our outcomes. Right now, the public is likely aware that your schools get a letter grade. They may not know that 96% of that letter grade is based off a standardized test score. And, well, there are no multiple choices in life. And the more we get students ready for multiple choice type tests, the less prepared they are for life after high school.
For some, the standardized tests have been controversial because of the words Common Core, which Arizona has changed the name of. When we come to standardized tests, what works and what is measurable that we can actually tell what's doing well for Arizona schools?
Well, let's be clear. We've got to be clear here between what is the standards and what aren't. The Common Core are a set of academic standards. All they indicate is what students should know and be able to do. There is no conspiracy plot here, no federal takeover. And we've had standards in Arizona for over 20 years. Now, the aspect of the standardized test that concerns me is the multiple choice nature of them. Mm-hmm. That is what impacts teaching and learning because students, well, I think you may remember how to answer a multiple choice test. You pick the two most logical ones, answers, you choose between one of those, and if all else fails, you pick C. And that really isn't the best way to get students prepared. My plan is to still have standards and still have assessments, but not have them count for 96% of how we evaluate schools and educators. And in its place, we're going to ratchet that back, and in its place, we're going to put some outcomes that get students ready, measures that matter after high school. And let me give you a few examples. Getting a career and technical education certificate, vocational education. When that happens right now, schools, our public schools, do not get any credit from the state, and I think they should. AP credits. Getting through a rigorous curriculum, that's the best way to get ready for college. Maybe certification in a programming language, or one more that I think could really be an asset to Arizona, and that is academic proficiency in more than one world language. We have that as a resource in Arizona, our language diversity, and I can't think of a better place to start if you want to get students internationally competitive than teaching them more than one world language.
Regardless of what administration is in office, there's always this battle of federal standards versus state standards. How complex does that get? If you're in this position, what are the challenges of saying federal standards, federal money, and yet we have some differences here in Arizona.
Well, let me be clear. The challenge is here, I was associate superintendent for the state of Arizona. I was in the office next door, so I know exactly what I'm getting into. I know how to get started day one. And what the challenge is for every state is how do we take into consideration the idea that we do need some national benchmarks? That's the biggest change in the current standards, is it allows us to know, our students to know, and our state to know, how do we stand relative to other states? And that is an improvement, and a question, by the way, that comes up all the time. The challenge for every state, Arizona included, is how do you implement the standards that is in the best interest of Arizona schools, Arizona parents, Arizona educators? That's where the real work is going to be, and where I will spend my time and energy as superintendent.
How is that work achievable? I mean, you're going to have voices from all sides. You've seen it before, having been in the office. You're getting people from different aspects. You're having a situation I've found where parents' expectations for teachers are high, which one would think is good, but they also seem unrealistic sometimes.
Well, we're already doing it in this campaign. I mean, think about this for a second. Our campaign has Arizona's teachers behind it, as well as the Arizona Chamber of Commerce and Industry. That combination doesn't come together very often on a campaign, and they've come together on the idea that I mentioned earlier, that the best way to get students prepared for life after high school are real-world measures and outcomes that matter. Now, the business community wants students who are proficient in a computer language or maybe proficient in multiple languages or ready for college, because that's great for workforce development. Teachers want it to happen because it improves teaching and learning at the school level. The reality is the kind of coalition that we have brought on board with my campaign means that we have more in common than we may think, and in many respects are actually moving toward the same ends. The challenge is, how do we get there?
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix with the Democratic nominee for Superintendent of Public Instruction in Arizona, David Garcia. David, why doesn't Arizona do better? And I mean in terms of, it always seems like we're in the bottom five when it comes to K-12 education. And that has been for a number of years. So there's got to be something that's not being done correctly here, whether we're measuring it against this or that. When you get in there, how much change can you bring about, considering funding comes from the legislature, considering there are going to be people who disagree with your ideas? I understand what you're saying about having the experience, having good ideas, but how do you implement those ideas?
Well, let me put it to you, put a little bit of perspective here. There is only one statewide elected official whose full-time job is K-12 education, and that's the superintendent of public instruction. The legislature, for example, is part-time, and they serve on several committees. And so in my opinion, it is the superintendent of public instruction who should be setting the agenda for public education in Arizona. And the way you do this is you work during the interim, the time away from the legislative session, working with communities across Arizona, with stakeholder groups that include parents and teachers and community organizations and local chambers of commerce, on a focused but very effective agenda that you work on together. You take advantage of the regulatory and policy opportunities that the office provides, but also the bully pulpit, to get out there and start changing our public conversations about the value and importance of public schools.
But funding is a big issue. Obviously, there's a ruling where Arizona schools could end up getting more than $300 million, but the legislature is still fighting it at this point. How big a difference does that money make? How much of a difference could that money make? What's the biggest improvement on top of that Arizona can make without any extra funding?
Well, first off, I think Arizona should. I think it's really a travesty that our schools had to go sue their leadership to implement what voters wanted. And I know there are challenges in terms of the budgetary constraints, but the reality is the public wants our public schools to, funding restored to our public schools. And they want that because when folks think of the money, what they're really, the focus is really on is opportunities. See, the challenge in Arizona is we have students in Arizona who have, different opportunities than others. And as a state, our students don't have the same opportunities as students from other states. And so, to me, the issue of resources really comes down to providing opportunities for our students. I mean, I think that is a significant role that the superintendent can and should play in the public discussion with regard to the direction of public schools.
David, one issue that became really controversial, at least to the two people who have held this office most recently, John Hubenthal and Tom Horn, is what happened in Tucson as far as La Raza, ethnic studies. Where should the superintendent stand on that? And how confusing was that, considering there was a report that came out, Superintendent Hubenthal didn't seem to quite have all the information there.
Well, I'm an advocate of local control. It's a big state, and I know many of our listeners have been around the state. It's tough to govern in, let's say, have something to say about the Navajo Nation or in Yuma if you spend all your time in Phoenix. So as a result, I do believe that local communities know their public schools best. I know that there are elected officials in local communities. Tucson, in this example, I do think that Tucson, I'm an advocate of the local control that they have. I do know that they have made changes to their ethnic studies program to be compliant with the law. From what I've seen, they have made some tremendous changes to the curriculum. And my first inclination is to encourage and promote local responsibility and local accountability. That's the way you're going to get things changed. It's real tough from Phoenix to go out to small communities or rural communities and be there enough to have the kind of impact to make a difference. What you want to have happen is you want local educators, you want the local community to step up, take responsibility and accountability. And I do think that is what the Tucson Unified School Board has done with the issue of ethnic studies.
David, finally, one thing we haven't discussed yet is school choice, which is a big thing here in Arizona. Where do you stand on school choice, where the priority should be for that, where the money's going?
Well, let me tell you, I'm an advocate of school choice. I see it a little bit different than most. For example, my two daughters attend a traditional public school in the Phoenix Elementary School District, and that is my choice. Oftentimes, we see parents who are in traditional public schools, we call them trapped or left behind. The reality is my daughters, because my wife and I are fortunate enough to send them anywhere we want to, and we choose a traditional public school. We got to remember that we have hundreds and thousands of parents who are making that choice. With regard to school choice options such as charter schools, I think that in many ways they've been healthy for Arizona. And one way in particular is many of our charter schools are smaller and more specialized than our traditional public schools. And that sets up a great opportunity for parents to match the interest of their child with the academic mission of the school. See, Steve, I don't believe there is one best school in Arizona, but I do believe there is the best school for your child. I have two daughters that are very different from each other in terms of how they learn. And I think one of the real advantages to Arizona is to have so many specialized options so that we can make a choice that matches their interest best. And that part has been very healthy with regard to school choice.
David Garcia is the Democratic nominee to be Arizona's next superintendent of public instruction. His Republican opponent, Diane Douglas, refused our invitation. David, thank you for the time.
Steve, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Still to come on Here and Now with early ballots going out tomorrow. We'll catch up on the general election campaign. Also, a conversation with ASU Athletic Director Ray Anderson. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Mesa Art Center. Direct from This American Life, humorist David Sedaris shares new stories and old favorites with biting satire and droll charm. David Sedaris, November 5th. Tickets at MesaArtCenter.com.
Good morning. This is KJZZ's Here and Now. We could see showers and thunderstorms across the state today. Even some snow showers are possible above the 11,000-foot level up in northern Arizona. Right now, it's cloudy and 60 degrees in Flagstaff, 65 in Prescott, 66 in Casa Grande, cloudy and 78 degrees in Tucson, cloudy and 77 right now in Yuma. You're invited to a special presentation about how to protect your financial future. Deanne Griebel from Moores and Cabot Investments will talk about how to avoid fraudulent investments. It's this Friday morning at 9. To learn more and to RSVP, call 480-774-8473. That's 480-774-8473. Cloudy skies and 75 degrees in Phoenix at 11:19.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein. Early ballots for November's general election go in the mail tomorrow. And if the general election is like the primary, and we suspect it will be, then a huge percentage of you will be sending your ballot in pretty quickly, well before November 4th. But in what other ways will the general resemble the primary here in Arizona? Will incumbents lose? Will Democrats actually win a statewide office, something they haven't been able to do recently? With me to review the general election season and preview what some of the outcomes may be are Bob Robb, Arizona Republic columnist, and State House Minority Leader Chad Campbell, who is not running for re-election or any other office in 2014. Welcome to you both.
Good to be with you.
Thanks.
Bob, let me start with you. The quality of the candidates out there, most of the races have a prominent D against a prominent R. Are Arizona voters getting good choices here?
I think they're getting exceptionally good choices, even though the advertising campaigns don't convey that, and that may be the largest disconnect for virtually every race on the ballot. Certainly for statewide office, you have highly qualified individuals who are well motivated to do good things for the state, have thought deeply about the issues that they will confront, and are utterly trashing each other on television over irrelevant things.
Chad, what about you?
Yeah, I would agree with what Bob said. And I think part of the problem we're seeing, especially when you look at the top of the ticket race, the governor's race, is that we have so much independent expenditure money now dominating the airwaves, you know, due to the change in campaign finance laws over the last few cycles. And these IE campaigns tend to be negative. They tend to go for these very rhetorical, kind of extremist, reactionary-based arguments on both sides of the equation. I'm not making this a partisan issue at all. And so instead of debating the issues and the merits and the qualifications of the candidates, you see these IEs picking out one or two bad things about the candidates and just really hammering on them repeatedly. And so we're not really seeing a substantive debate this year, and that's unfortunate because we have a lot of good candidates running for all of the offices.
I wouldn't let the candidates off the hook. I don't think the quality of their advertising is any more substantive than that of the IEs.
One that has really stood out for me is the Rodolini versus Brnovich for Attorney General. And I know that they're both aggressive candidates. They both obviously want to win. I think the feeling was, though, Bob, with Tom Horn losing in the primary, that perhaps it would be a little less slimy. Were you not expecting that?
I wasn't expecting what we've gotten. And this has been the deepest disappointment of any of the races for me. In reality, Rotolini and Brnovich are both exceptionally well qualified for the position. They have the background and experience to bring to the job. They've both have managed state offices pretty well, and they both have a similar and right view of the office, that it's there to provide legal representation and legal advice, not to be a policymaker. There are real issues confronting that office. You've got demoralization from the checkered tenure of Tom Horn. You've got budget constraints. The legislature wasn't kind to that office when Democrat Attorney General Terry Goddard had it. Horn hasn't fared much better. So you're going to have to be setting priorities. There's things that that office does that you're going to have to sort through and create some priorities. And there's been none of that in the discussion between the two candidates. It's been nitpicking at their records and accusations that they're unqualified, and a debate that, frankly, is completely irrelevant.
Chad, has that one stood out to you, or is there another race that would also fall into that category?
I don't think that one stood out to me any more so than the others, to be honest with you. I think maybe it stands out because of the Tom Horn factor coming out of the primary, which you and Bob just discussed. But I think, again, across the board, we really have, and maybe this is just my own short-term memory kicking in here or something, but we really have seen a lack of debate around the issues facing Arizona as compared to previous election cycles. It's been more about the attacks on the other person, more about the attacks on the party, and not some of the big issues we're facing. And especially, you know, we saw the news today. We have a huge deficit on the horizon for Arizona once again, which is something that many of us predicted. And a lot of us have been concerned about some of the policies that have been enacted over the past several years. And we're not seeing a debate about what we're going to do to actually address this budget deficit head on, and that's concerning. We have a very, very serious problem coming down the line here in Arizona. We have a huge revenue gap. We're already underfunding many programs in this state. At least some of us believe that. And we're not seeing a debate on that. And that is concerning. And the voters of Arizona need to know how we're going to take this budget deficit head on. We cannot just duck our heads or put our heads in the sand and wish away a $500 million deficit. That is not going to happen.
That's a fair point. But Bob, I wonder if that, do we ever expect these gubernatorial finalists to actually tell us, it's always, sand tends to be these days, look on my website for my plan, or I've got a five-point plan. I guess I wonder until they actually get in there and dig in. One would think Mr. Ducey would have a little more knowledge of that, having been state treasurer, although he doesn't handle the budget, clearly.
And although I have faulted the candidates for not speaking to this issue and faulted them fairly significantly, politically and substantively, I understand it. When you've got a deficit this big, it takes all experts' hands on deck to flesh out what your realistic options are. The legislature has a couple score of budget experts to provide those options for them. The governor's office has about a score. And the candidates have two or three guys who know something about the budget whispering in their ears. So they really don't have the expertise on hand to flesh out the options for a problem this big. But the other problem is that there's utterly nothing you can say about how you're going to handle this deficit that won't hurt your prospects of being elected. It's all bad news. It's going to be all adverse political choices. And so while it is terribly frustrating, since the budget deficit is going to consume at least the first 2 years and probably the whole term of whoever gets elected, it's understandable that there's not much discussion of it that's substantive occurring in the campaign.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix with Bob Robb and Chad Campbell talking about the general election campaign. Chad, go ahead.
Yeah, Steve, let me just add, though, and I think, and again, I could say this about many of the candidates, and I don't want to try to pick on one, but I'm going to regardless. You know, I think to that point about the budget deficit and how it will harm your candidate's chances or your campaign chances, I agree with that. But I also don't think that you as a candidate should be saying things that you know are not fiscally possible. And the fact that Doug Ducey continues to talk about eliminating the state income tax to me is downright irresponsible. We cannot eliminate income tax in the state. There is no feasible way without raising other taxes substantially, which he says he's not going to do. So to continue harping on that talking point that came from his primary election and act like that's a reality is really disingenuous in my eyes to the voters, because any economist that you talk to, anybody that I've talked to at least, and anybody in the business community I talk to, we all know you can't eliminate the income tax in Arizona. We don't have oil revenues. We don't have gambling revenues like Texas or Nevada. We have to rely on a very broad-based tax solution here. And to say you're going to eliminate the income tax to try to pick up votes, it's just something that it's really bothered me as a person who's been in office for the past 8 years and worked on the budget. That's a very disingenuous selling point. And I think it's troubling me to know that we have a candidate for the top office in the state who's saying that continually, even though we know that's not possible.
And I would add that Duvall's spending plans are equally as unrealistic and I think equally as irresponsible.
Chad, let me come back.
And Bob, I would just say, I mean, again, we have to talk about revenue in the state. And you and I think, you and I have talked about this in the past.
Well, but both candidates.
And spend accordingly or raise revenue and spend accordingly. But you can't talk at both sides of your mouth, and that's true for every candidate, regardless of their partisan label.
And both of them are doing it. Duvall has ruled out a tax increase, even though he supported one 2 years ago.
Chad, let me go quickly back to the politics of it. We've got about 2 minutes left here to discuss this. Going back to Duvall, now you were someone who at least the Railbirds were saying might have been a challenger to Fred Duvall in the Democratic gubernatorial race. Did it hurt Duvall to not have a primary opponent? Is he having to ramp up here even for name recognition?
Yeah, I think it did. And, you know, and I feel bad that I didn't run still, and that was for personal reasons that I didn't run. And I know that Dr. Carmona decided against running as well. And I think it would have been better for Democrats if we had had a primary, be it me and Fred or Richard Carmona and Fred or Fred or me and Carmona, whoever. I mean, a primary gets that name ID out there. It kind of puts you through a bit of a battle and tests you. And I think we needed a primary. And I think a lot of people who probably were happy at first we didn't have a primary would now say the same thing.
I would disagree. Duvall is a highly politically experienced individual. I think he came out of the chutes with his sea legs under him. I don't think there's been a problem. He is getting seriously outspent as it is. And I think it was far more important for his chances to be able to husband his resources rather than be tested in a primary.
Gentlemen, let's wrap it up this way. All right, Chad, quickly, go ahead, quickly.
No, I was going to say, and I think Fred has done an amazing job coming out of the gates. I don't want to imply otherwise. But I will disagree. I think the Democrats as a whole would have been better off. And the last time we won the governor's race in the state was when we had a contested primary. And it was a tough primary. But it did challenge our candidates and make them, I think, refine their machine as they came into the general election.
There was also a third-party candidate who probably helped a little bit as well, looking back then. All right, finally, guys, because I'm curious about this. Democrats don't have any statewide offices right now, but they have some big-name candidates, whether it's Terry Goddard, whether it's Felicia Rodellini. Bob, you first. How many Democrats win statewide office?
I'll be surprised if at least one doesn't.
Going on a limb there.
You've got the huge Republican built-in advantage in an off-presidential year and a national election that's trending Republican. So it's a big uphill climb.
Who do you give the best chances to?
I think in a low-budget race that Terry Goddard's residual name ID gives him the best shot.
Okay. Chad, what about you?
Yeah, and I think we have a shot in every race. I think all of our candidates are doing amazing jobs, despite the national trend that Bob is talking about, and I agree with him. I think it is going to be a Republican year nationally. But I think we have an amazing slate of candidates who are running really good races. And I agree with Bob on who probably our best shot is, and that's Terry. I think Terry has name ID. We've seen, you know, no offense to Michelle Regan, but we've seen a lackluster campaign in terms of fundraising from her. And I think Terry Goddard's name ID is going to push him over the top on that race. And I think we can win other races as well, but I do put Goddard as number one.
House Minority Leader Chad Campbell, Bob Robb of the Arizona Republic. You can read him Wednesdays, Fridays, and Sundays, also online. Thanks to you both.
Good to be with you.
Thank you.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein. The United States Supreme Court this morning temporarily halted the march toward legal gay marriage in another round of states. Justice Anthony Kennedy granted a request to block yesterday's 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals decision overturning gay marriage bans in Idaho and Nevada. It's the third development in as many days. KJZZ's Nick Blumberg has been covering the story and joins me in studio now on microphone number three.
That is correct.
Nick, what did the stay from the Supreme Court mean?
Well, Steve, Justice Kennedy granted this stay after an appeal from the state of Idaho, which is still defending its ban. Nevada is not. Idaho asked the Supreme Court for an emergency stay so it wouldn't have to start issuing marriage licenses to gay and lesbian couples. So the state has indicated it plans to appeal the ruling overturning its gay marriage ban. That ruling came from a 3-judge panel of the Ninth Circuit. Idaho plans to ask for a hearing before a full 11-judge panel of the Ninth Circuit. If it loses that round, as is very possible, it'll appeal to the Supreme Court. So it appears that Justice Kennedy is giving them time to at least start that appeals process before officials have to start granting marriage licenses for same-sex couples.
And how important was the move by the Supreme Court on Monday that seems to have spurred the Ninth Circuit to act in Nevada and Idaho?
Yeah, absolutely. The Supreme Court declined to hear cases regarding gay marriage bans in Utah, Oklahoma, Wisconsin, Indiana, and Virginia. So it basically let lower court rulings stand, effectively approving gay marriage in those states. So the Ninth Circuit had heard arguments against Idaho and Nevada's bans last month. So yesterday they released a pretty unequivocal ruling against those laws. It seems like the Ninth Circuit may have been waiting for the Supreme Court to do something on gay marriage. This opinion seems like it was drafted and written and ready to go.
So if the Supreme Court effectively allowed gay marriage in several states to go forward this week, why would it put the Ninth Circuit ruling on hold?
It was a very brief order from the court, so we don't really have any insight into why they granted Idaho's appeal. This delay could be pretty short-lived. Plaintiffs have until 5 o'clock tomorrow to respond, so this could be a somewhat procedural move, though it's often very difficult, as you know, to predict what the Supreme Court is thinking. And at least on the face of it, it seems sort of unlikely that the Supreme Court would ultimately overturn the Ninth Circuit decision in favor of gay marriage, especially after it did just the opposite in 5 states earlier this week.
So where does this leave Arizona's gay marriage ban, then?
Right. Plaintiffs who are arguing against Arizona's ban were obviously very happy with the Ninth Circuit ruling. Since we're also part of the Ninth Circuit, it creates a pretty clear legal precedent. So lawyers are planning very soon to file a request with Judge John Sedgwick, who's hearing the case against Arizona's anti-gay marriage law in federal district court. So they want to ask Sedgwick to immediately rule that Arizona's ban is illegal based on that Ninth Circuit ruling. Now, the Supreme Court's emergency stay of the Ninth Circuit ruling could delay things here in Arizona, but it's unclear for how long. The lawyers arguing in favor of gay marriage seem to feel pretty confident Sedgwick's going to rule in their favor. He already ordered the state of Arizona to recognize an out-of-state gay marriage for a terminally ill man, and he sort of indicated he thinks the ban here in Arizona is probably unconstitutional.
So what's our timeline? When can we expect something to happen with the Ninth Circuit ruling, the ban here in Arizona?
Yeah, the only thing we really know for sure right now is that the plaintiffs in the Idaho case have until 5 tomorrow evening to file their response with the Supreme Court. Other than that, it's all fluid, but obviously the developments have been coming really quickly of late, so we could know more very soon about the fate of that Ninth Circuit ruling. As far as Arizona, if Judge Sedgwick does rule against Arizona's anti-gay marriage law, the state of Arizona could appeal. I spoke with the Attorney General's office yesterday. They wouldn't say whether they would plan to hypothetically appeal such a ruling, but it certainly wouldn't be unexpected for them to do so. And based on this week's, you know, sort of tacit approval from the Supreme Court and the opinion from the Ninth Circuit, it's not really clear how likely an appeal from Arizona would be to succeed.
KJZZ's Nick Blumberg with the latest on same-sex marriage. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. The National Football League has become the most popular sport in the U.S., but recent scandals involving Baltimore Ravens running back Ray Rice and other players accused of domestic violence could threaten fan loyalty. Ray Anderson, Arizona State University's Vice President of Athletics and Athletic Director, is also a former executive with the NFL. He'll be speaking on Thursday morning at the Marriott Desert Ridge as part of the W.P. Carey School of Business's Economic Club of Phoenix presentations. Anderson and I spoke earlier about the differences between working in pro and college athletics and how important image is in the world of sports.
Image to the professional sports leagues are critical because a lot of what they do is driven by advertiser sponsorship dollars, TV dollars, and the folks who provide those investments don't want to do so to a business that has a lot of bad conduct, behavior issues, bad character. So image is critically important at the professional level. And very frankly, image is important at the college level. There's a big business component, and people are not inclined to give to any business, particularly in a sports or entertainment, where it seems that some of the players don't seem to understand that they are models that people see, kids emulate. So that image is critically important, and if you're not paying attention to it, you will find yourself in harm's way, unfortunately, like the NFL finds itself right now because they weren't paying enough attention to the negative image that comes from domestic violence and other abuse when it's carried out by big, strong guys against folks who aren't as able to protect themselves. Image is vitally important, and you got to pay attention to it and be proactive in making sure you're educating your players so that they don't get themselves in a situation where they're ruining their image, they're negatively impacting lives, and also negatively impacting and affecting the image of the professional organization or college organization.
Would there be any kind of advice from what you saw from afar? You obviously still have a lot of friends at the NFL level, that in certain ways things could have been handled better.
I think you have to understand that there's certain things that happen where you don't have the internal expertise to be able to make the most informed decision. And I think the lesson there is that when you have an area, get the appropriate expertise from folks external to help you internally get to more vetted decisions. And if there's any criticism, and they will admit it by their actions in essentially going to bring those folks on as consultants, they've acknowledged that that was a mistake, that you were dealing in an area that is so serious, yet you didn't take enough energy to get people who are really experts in those areas to come in and help you make your decisions.
I want to come back to the image question a little bit because, of course, we heard about the sponsors, and you mentioned them, of course, and the money that they provide. There's a little bit of part of me, though, that I feel like that's hypocrisy. We don't know what these companies, what they're doing behind the scenes either, and now they're saying, oh, boy, well, the NFL screwed up publicly, so we're going to take it to them.
You know what? Your point is well taken, but here's the deal. The NFL and professional sports and top college programs, they have the platform. That's what people pay attention to. They're not really paying attention to what might be some of the negative things going on behind the scenes at one of the Fortune 500 companies, because it's just not as relevant to the normal Joe and Jane out there in the street. But the NFL, with the platform it has, and it's worked hard to give itself that platform, then you got to take some of the high microscope heat when it comes your way. So it doesn't have to be fair, and some of it may have some hypocrisy behind it, but the fact is that the NFL presents itself as a platform where a lot of people pay attention. They extract a lot of money from the sponsors to be associated with the NFL. And so there's a higher expectation and a higher standard for behavior. And when you don't live up to it, you're going to be exposed much more so than, you know, corporation number 453.
What are the biggest differences you've seen so far between having a major position with a national sports organization and now a huge public university?
Well, certainly it's the environment by necessity with the student athletes and being in the higher education community. There's just a lot more youthful energy. There is a sense of, and a more significant sense of real community, because it's all about ASU. So it's all about this institution, as opposed in the NFL, it was about, you know, 32 different organizations. There certainly is there's still innocence here and curiosity with the young student athletes and the student body in general that you don't get at the professional level. And there's an opportunity, a palpable opportunity, to really make an influence and impact young men and women that I frankly don't believe exist at the NFL level. Once you get to the pro level, they just have a different track. And so those are the things that are the real difference. This is more personally and professionally gratifying, because you really, frankly, are involved with students and young men and women.
Money obviously drives so many things, but what are the differences when it comes to trying to get alumni, folks, to give money to a university, as opposed to dealing at the NFL level, where it seems like everyone's at least, if not a billionaire, close to it?
The difference is that you can legitimately hear claim that this is going as much toward the academic experience as well as the athletic experience, because the great majority, 98-point-something% of our student athletes will never do anything at the professional level, not in terms of trying to make a living. So you can legitimately make the pitch that this is for the academic and athletic maturity and opportunities for our young men and women. And it's just a something that more people can relate to, as opposed to, well, it's just going toward professionals who are already making enough and they've already had opportunities and they'll have so many other opportunities. It's very frankly a more genuine, compassionate sell, and people are quicker, I've learned already, to respond, because the NFL, very frankly, is strictly business.
Ray, NBA just announced it'll be extending contracts with ESPN and TNT, also local contracts and MLB expanding dramatically. How important is the TV funding to what pro leagues are trying to do, even what the major college conferences are? I mean, there's a Pac-12 network, there's an SEC network now, for example.
Critically important, because you have to have the revenues to reinvest in your programs, facilities, academic and other life skill support programs. And if you don't have it, you will fall behind the competition, because the big programs who are well-funded, Alabama, Oregon, et cetera, they, Stanford, you know, they have mechanism to make sure they have revenues supporting their business. So the Pac-12 TV, for instance, it's really important to schools that maybe don't have as much access to endowment dollars to really be able to push your programs forward, reinvest in your facilities, reinvest in your student-athlete program. So at the collegiate level, it is really getting more and more important. At the pro level, it's always front and center.
Ray Anderson, ASU's Vice President of Athletics and Athletic Director. He'll be speaking tomorrow morning at the Marriott Desert Ridge as part of the W.P. Carey School of Business's Economic Club of Phoenix presentations. And still to come on Here and Now, we'll talk with Ann Ryman of the Arizona Republic about a major ASU athletic facilities announcement today, and we'll find out about Arizona Theater Company's Cafe Bohemia. Stay tuned. KJZZ is supported by APS.
Next for APS means putting our state's most abundant natural resource to work by harnessing solar energy during the day to power Arizona at night. APS.com/next. The future of energy is bright.
Good morning. You're listening to Here and Now on 91.5 FM and KJZZ.org. Valley forecast calling for cloudy skies and a 70% chance of showers today. We should see a high of 80 degrees. Partly cloudy skies tonight and a 30% chance for some more rain on into tomorrow as well, when our high will be 84 degrees. Join us at 12 o'clock for Here and Now from Boston. A battle is raging for the Syrian town of Kobani, and human rights groups are warning of a bloodbath if the militant group ISIS prevails. NPR's Here and Now starts at noon on KJZZ. Cloudy skies and 75 degrees right now in Phoenix at 11:45.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. As we mentioned in the interview with Ray Anderson, money is a big part of college athletics. ASU is in the midst of a major fundraising campaign to renovate Sun Devil Stadium. And this morning, school president Michael Crow made an announcement about long-term plans for ASU's athletic facilities district. Ann Ryman, who covers higher education for the Arizona Republic and AZ Central, attended today's press conference and joins me now. Hi, Ann. Good morning.
Good morning.
So can you give us some background first? What is the ASU Athletic Facilities District, and what does it enable the school to do?
This is basically an area. It's south of Tempe Town Lake, and it covers about 330 acres. It's, if you're familiar with the Tempe campus, it's the north end of the campus. And essentially what's there now is a golf course and parking lots. And because of a change in state law a couple years ago, universities now can develop property, and they can use the proceeds, whoever goes there can pay a fee to the universities, and the money will go to fund renovations and new athletic facilities.
And is that in lieu of property tax, Ann?
It is, yes. Universities don't pay property taxes, so instead of a property tax, a business there would pay a fee to the university.
So what was at the core of what President Crow announced this morning, and how big a deal is it?
This is an enormous area to develop. I mean, universities do get into development agreements, but it's usually for, like, smaller parcels. This is 330 acres, the equivalent of basically 50 city blocks.
Wow. Okay. Is this a game changer for ASU as far as flexibility and the ability to bring in more revenue?
It very well could be. They see it as a way to bring in revenue for their athletic facilities, but also it's expected to create a lot of economic development for Tempe. And they also, ASU also sees it as part of their, you know, the development, what goes there, they're envisioning it will be very sustainable. You know, it could be commercial, residential, retail, just about anything you could think of.
And how long term is the project?
The project's going to take a while to develop, anywhere from probably 10 to 20 years, and they don't even probably expect to put a shovel in the ground for another 2 years.
I already had a chance to read your story online at azcentral.com, and one of the things that seemed to be emphasized was the excitement about who the master developer is going to be. Can you give us some background on that company and why it's considered to be so significant?
Yes, I mean, basically, this is a California-based company. They're based in Oakland, and they've done a number of developments throughout California, and they also have one currently underway in Austin, Texas. They were chosen because they do very large developments. You know, they have one that's about 300 acres and another that's about 700 acres. They also have incorporate a lot of the green building, energy saving features that, you know, that's really an emphasis for ASU. ASU originally had a handful of people who kind of made the final cut, and they were looking at the four of them. And when I saw that this company, it's pronounced Catalyst, was chosen, I really wasn't surprised, just given their background in especially the sustainability area.
And not sure if you would have had a chance to look into this, but is this something that other states are trying, other big public universities based on their state legislatures are trying?
I'm not aware of something exactly like this. I mean, it's not unusual for a university to have unused land that they'll try to develop, but to actually have a mechanism where it's able to fund a certain thing is pretty unusual.
And as we mentioned already, the state legislature got involved with this a few years back. Any word on something that U of A would be trying something like this in Tucson?
Now, U of A and NAU under the law can do this. I'm not aware of anything that U of A is currently doing right now to pursue this, though. Basically, the law was changed, and ASU was really, really spearheaded that change, specifically because they wanted to, renovate Sun Devil Stadium.
And last question for you. You mentioned economic development, sustainable development. I know the mayor of Tempe, Mark Mitchell, was out at the press conference, too. Did he add anything to it? Did he have anything specific to say about the relationship between Tempe and ASU?
Yes, he called this a very innovative project, and he, again, emphasized the scale of it. In fact, he was the one that, kind of put it in perspective. It's kind of hard to envision 330 acres, so he was the one who kind of brought it down to scale. Like, this is the equivalent of 50 city blocks, and basically he said it could fund, thousands of jobs, not only just during the construction phase, but later on when you've got, retail, commercial there.
Ann Ryman covers higher education for the Arizona Republic and AZ Central. Ann, thanks very much for the time.
Thank you.
You're listening to Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein. Arizona Theater Company is best known for presenting well-known and award-winning productions featuring professional, often established talent. But the company also offers Cafe Bohemia, a series of play readings and ideas from up-and-coming, sometimes raw playwrights. With me to offer more details about the kickoff of this season's Cafe Bohemia is Stephen Rentmore, Associate Artistic Director, and Caridad Svich, who will do the reading of Archipelago, her play at the Herberger Theater Center's CAC stage, Saturday night at 7. Welcome to you both.
It's Sunday night and hello.
Oh, Sunday night. I'm sorry. So
that's
Saturday
okay.
night
We're
in Tucson.
Saturday night in Tucson, and
terrific.
Sunday night will be in Phoenix. And this is the new development for us. We've known forever that the core of the theatre, the future of theatre, is in our writers. And so, whilst ATC is celebrating the greatest writers of America's and the world on our main stage, what we're also doing is investing in the generation of writers who will come, but also those established writers who are finding new voices and asking new questions and writing new stories. And that's really why I celebrate Caridad so much.
Well, Caridad, tell us about Archipelago. What was your inspiration for it? And if you don't mind, what is the plot?
Oh, what is the plot? That's the hardest question. So I'll start with inspiration first. Inspiration was that I wanted to tell a love story. Who's not a sucker for a love story, So, and I was working on another play, which was an adaptation of a Marquez novel, and I was sort of already in the world of love, as it were, with that story. But I wanted to tell my own story, so I felt like I wanted to tell something that treated the stage space in a very poetic way. I wanted to work with a love story that spanned many, what would feel like a long span of time. Also, a distance and also sort of a cross-cultural love story that wasn't dead on in its specificity, but that could find its way in a performance with actors who would bring their own histories to the play. So that was the initial inspiration, as well as many other formal questions, which would probably bore your listeners to tears. but, they have to do with being a writer girl. And then, in terms of plot, it's really that. It's two lovers find themselves across time, in and out of each other, in and out of love. And it's about the sustenance of that. Is it a memory of love, or is it the real deal? We don't know.
I want to have you both address this. Stephen, let me start with you. How do great playwrights in this day and age develop and emerge?
It's very challenging. There are a number of opportunities at a number of different stages, but there's also a sense that given an opportunity, anything can be possible, but getting the opportunity is the challenge. And how you take a play that's burgeoning with ideas and possibility out of a black box space and put it on a main stage where you increase awareness, availability, curiosity. And there are a number of theatres that do it across America, and we're doing it in our own sense with a different sort of play. But you also see that plays that emerge and grow on Broadway, tend to, or off-Broadway, or off-Broadway, radiate out across America. And I think this is one of the cores of the repertory movement, that we were to be amplifiers of the great works that were emerging out of metropolitan centres like New York, or London, indeed, which is my hometown. And so, whilst there's a very different attitude to theatre in the UK, and particularly how plays get developed, I think predominantly because we had Shakespeare, and so we feel a sense of responsibility to supporting and celebrating writers. But what we also have in America is these opportunities where the great American story and the story that tells us what our life is explored in front of us on the stage. And this is what Archipelago does so extraordinarily well. What Caridad didn't mention is that it's also about the boundaries that we live through and with, and she calls it a man and a woman, but it's also a man from one side of the border and a girl from another side of the border. But she never defines what that border is, and it might be the barrier that means that we never know each other properly, and it might be the border that's 150 miles south of us, or it might be the border in another country.
Well, Caridad, let's come back to the creative process then for you, because what you've described, what Stephen has described, I mean, this is not something that just comes to someone overnight, and I wonder when it's something that is this, it sounds very intimate, sounds very personal. How do you develop it to a point where, how are you not sensitive to criticism, even constructive criticism?
Oh, my heavens. You know, I think that as a writer, all you can do is face the page and trust. Otherwise, you don't write anything, you know? So I feel like, you know, for me, that first pass with the play was just about the idea came upon me. And when I write, I just want to write it down as quickly as I can, because I always think it's going to run away, even though it's not true. But there is always this fear, like the play's going to vanish. It's the play's going to vanish, and I'll never catch it. But I also think that the process with this play was very full. I did want to write something that was very intimate. I also am interested in intimacy on stage in terms of an audience's relationship to material and to performers and bodies in space. And I also wanted to create something that felt immediate in its affect and hopefully timeless as well. So it's sort of a tricky bind, you know, to contemporary, but also let it live in a kind of mythic space. And it's also the voice of the play, you know, overall tends to be closer to the work that I've done in poetry, which I've always kept slightly hidden. And I sort of gave myself a charge when writing this piece that I would not hide it anymore, that I would actually put it on paper and make a play out of it, you know, this time. And it's sort of a span, you know, this play sort of kicked off a series of plays. So I've written from this play, you know, 12 plays since then, literally in the span of less than a year. I think, you know, this play's been sort of like, I don't know what they call it, you know, the gushing stream or something, but all of these other plays have followed it. And I think because of Archipelago.
I think as well, one of the things, one of the inceptions of Café Bohemia was an understanding that there's this mythical idea that writers live in a closed room in the dark and through the midnight hours with coffee write or scream at the walls. And what I wanted to do is introduce our audiences to the moment where a play gets shared at its inception. So there's something very private, as Caridad mentioned in the play, but there's also something about, the name isn't accidental, it's a café, you know, it's an open, relaxed atmosphere. But the bohemian thing means that it's a place where ideas get discussed. It's, what if this play became something bigger? And you were there on the night where it first got read, and you share these ideas. And what you, as an audience, and we as a theatre company do, is contribute to the idea that plays don't just arrive ready-made. There aren't any gold-plated classics that arrive out of nowhere. There's gestation, and there's time. And a great example is War Horse, which began in a basement in a black space that was probably 10 foot square in a place called Battersea in South London. And the ideas got thrown around for a year and a half, and then they got workshopped at a studio space at the National Theatre. And then 2 and a bit years later, it's amazing. Out of nowhere, this great hit has arrived. My point is that they always start somewhere, and they start with collaboration. And just like cells divide to make a new body, what you have in theatre is, for me, the inception with the artist, the writer, then a partnership, and in this case it's with me. And then the next partnership is with ATC, and then the next partnership is with the actors. And so you have something born.
Stephen Rentmore is Associate Artistic Director of Arizona Theatre Company, talking about this season's Café Bohemia, which kicks off here in Phoenix on Sunday night at 7 at the Herberger Theater Center's CAC stage. The writer of the first play, Archipelago, also joined us, Caridad Svich. Caridad, thanks so much for joining us from the East Coast. Stephen, thank you as well.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And thank you very much for listening to today's edition of KJZZ's Here and Now. If you missed any of our segments or want to go back and catch them again, it'll be online later this afternoon at KJZZ.org. You can also download the KJZZ app to your smartphone. Thanks very much to senior producer Sarah Ventry and Bruce Drummond for their help on today's program. Stay tuned for NPR's Here and Now next on listener-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. We'll be keeping track of the rain falling around the valley at this hour. I'm Steve Goldstein. Have a great afternoon. It's 12 o'clock.